in Oregon in particular, or where?
Okay. I'm trying to think if it was Oregon or Virginia, but I think it was Oregon. You mentioned assessments because
sure.
That's it,
Sure. So Oregon's an interesting test case. They have a number of different assessment instruments they're using for a number of different reasons. So for determining the amount of support that folks get in-home, they have a homegrown instrument, which they call the Adults Needs Assessment, so not creatively named, but the ANA. They also have a Child Needs Assessment, the CNA. So that determines, if you're getting in-home services, the number of hours that will be authorized through. They have a 1915K plan, state plan amendment. For services for group homes, people get the Supports Intensity Scale, or the SIS, and that determines a tier, and that tier determines at the rate the provider is paid for delivering services. And then they're using a different assessment instrument for another program that was not part of our scope of work, so at the moment I can't recall what it is. Based upon legislative direction and stakeholder feedback, they've decided to move away from all of their existing assessment instruments, establish a brand new assessment, which they call the Oregon Needs Assessment. So again, another creatively named instrument, the ONA, as we like to call it. They're in the process of, they've completed a pilot project on that. They're now in the process of validating it. And again, based upon some input from the stakeholders, they're going to do a revalidation. They're working with Oregon State University, as I recall, to revalidate that. Once that work is done, we're going to have to come behind and crosswalk existing rate tiers that were based upon other assessments to the new assessment instrument to, again, segue people from the old to the new.
I just had to follow up. Is there this great assessment? I mean, assessments are really critical, obviously, on how you fund and what your rates are and who gets served. And I'm always skeptical. I'm a parent.
Sure.
Do you teach to the test kind of thing, and are you accurate? Because if somebody proves it a great deal or doesn't show something someday,
sure,
then they're not qualified or they're not served. So I don't want you to try to figure out one is best, but overall your experience at the end, I'm curious to know if you found one that makes the most sense. I know everybody's.
Yeah, so I'm not going to try to speak to what's best. I can tell you what's most frequent, and because other folks have made determinations about what assessment works for their states. So within the IDD space, the Supports Intensity Scale is used by more states than any other assessment instrument. The Supports Intensity Scale, which everyone refers to, is the SIS. ICAP is a more legacy tool, so that's used by, I think, probably 10 or 12. The SIS is used in about half the states, maybe a little bit more than half the states. ICAP's used, I think, in about 10 or 12. There's another instrument, which I never quite remember, know how to pronounce. It's called the Inter-I, but it's Inter-R-A-I, so I don't know if it's the Inter-I or the Inter-Ray. That is being marketed because it has different modules. So there's an IDD module, but then there's also an elderly module and a physical disability, a TBI module. So states like it because it's part of the same suite of instruments. There's a number of homegrown instruments, some of which have been taken outside the state, so like the NC-SNAP. Which was created in North Carolina, is used actually by more states than North Carolina, a handful of others. I think New York has their own individual assessment. So there's a number that are out there. It's hard to say that I'm not in a position where I'm not a clinician to say one's better than another, but I can tell you what seems to be most popular. And then the other challenge of answering that question is, what are we basing the answer on? A lot of folks are going to agree that any of those instruments do a good job of helping facilitate service planning, right? It's doing an inventory of people's needs, their desires, their goals, and the level of support that they need. The controversy erupts when you begin tying that to dollars, either through rates or individualized budgeting, right? And people might have liked the SIS previously, but then when we're saying, well, based upon the SIS, this is the amount of a budget or the rate that you're going to get, then people's opinion tends to change depending upon how their results turn out. So that's why you actually see some pushback on all these assessment instruments based upon how they're being used. And I guess the last point I'll make as it relates to assessments, and this is going a little bit off topic because it's not what we're tasked to look at here in California, but I think it's always important whenever we're talking about assessments to recognize kind of the point that you made, that people are unique individuals, right? So the assessments are going to work. I think any of those assessments can work in the majority of cases, but whenever you're considering an assessment-based system, whether it's for budgeting or for rates, you need to allow for exceptions, that people need to be able to identify that that for whatever reason, the assessment results just don't capture my specific circumstances, and therefore I need more than what I would otherwise receive. And that's, again, a big part of our work when we're doing that is helping design that appeals process and figuring out what the avenues that folks have for identifying themselves and going through a review process with the state. Yes, sir.
Hey, thanks so far for your presentation. Marty Emoto, California Disability Community Action Network, and a family member. Two things. One is to take off on what Connie just said about assessments and her concerns about that, is that that's a legitimate concern, one that a lot of us around this table share, because in previous budget years here in California, the use of assessments were used to actually reduce services, even though the state would have said or did try to say that it was meant to enhance quality or something. And they did things such as in-home services, for instance, to impose changes in what they referred to as the functional index score and things like that. And so for a lot of us around this table, we would view the assessment process as one of deep concern, because we can make the rates work, or the state can make the rates work, but if the assessment process is meant to limit who gets services because of the amount of money that is put in rates or not put in rates, then that's going to have an adverse effect, the people that need to be served. And I think you were trying to push forward was that whatever assessment process is used within the state, it needs to be done in a person-centered planning way and thinking way, because then individual exceptions would always be taken into account. The issues of disparities would be addressed. And so that obviously is not the main focus of your rate study, but it is linked to it inherently, because there's no way the rates can work separately from having an assessment process that is valid, that is credible, that is based on a person-centered way in California, or else the rates will never work. Second, you mentioned, and I meant to comment earlier, about the rate reductions that were recommended. And I think that's obviously going to be a red flag for a lot of people, is because why would anybody want a rate reduction? I mean, I'm assuming the providers weren't recommending that, right? They weren't saying, hey, reduce our rates. And so a couple of questions behind that is, was your mandate is, here's a pot of money, $100 million, we got to reduce the waiting list. How do we make that work within this pot of money? The second thing is, what was the impact? Someone asked a question about the waiting list as a result of reducing the rate. Will, you were asking that question. As a result of reducing the rate, there was some kind of action in reducing the waiting list. But the question that I would have is, how did the reduction of rates in the people who were already receiving services? In other words, what's the outcome beyond just that you're reducing a number on the waiting list? And what was the quality of services being provided to people on the waiting list who are now getting services, and also the people who were getting services already? And what's the person-centered process that was used to measure those outcomes? And you may not have an answer to any of those questions. It's just that the reduction of provider rates would raise red flags. And thank you.
Sure. So,
real quick, Stephen, for you, I just wanted to sort of bring up the point, though, that, you know, being California, these are a lot of issues we're not going to have to deal with in this study. It's sort of outside the scope of what we're doing. You know, we've asked Burns to really look at sort of, you know, how are rates set, how are they going to be sustainable going forward, you know, all the things we've talked about in this group is sort of what we've tasked them with. So, I mean, I think, you know, assessments and wait lists and things are things we don't, unfortunately, have to deal with in this state. You know, we still have the entitlement. We have a person-centered plan. We're working in the department to
Chris,
make it.
And I agree with you to a point, except that we do, they're not official waiting lists. But the fact is, because rates or the resources aren't out there in the community, the very fact that we talk about safety net and capacity is some of the issues that as families, regional centers, all of us collectively have said, yeah, there's not an official waiting list in the same sense that there exists in other states because of the Medicaid waiver, and there's a cap on the waiver. But there is waiting lists in the state of California, in that people wait to get services because it's not there in the community. it's not because of anyone's trying to be mean about it in the regional centers or anything. There's just not the capacity to provide needed resources in the community. And so it's really important that we don't think that the entitlement in California, the Lanterman Act, provides some kind of shield or protection providing services or dealing with the issue of capacity. The very issue of capacity and this issue strikes at the heart of whether or not a rate set can be credible and resolve the issues that families and others have raised across the state. So it wasn't, I mean, I understand what you're saying, the scope, but we have waiting lists. It's not caused by anybody, it's not an attack on the regional centers or anybody. It's because the capacity is not out there in the community.
Thank you.
Did you want to, Dan?
Well, I'd like to address a couple of points that were made. There were a lot of questions there. I'll do my best to remember what you asked and to provide a response to each. So the first question that I'm going to answer, at least, was have we been given a target to hit by the state? And that's not the way we do business. The state doesn't say this is how much money we have to work with. You need to build a rate system that reflects that. The way we like to, and I think I get to this later in the presentation, the way we like to build rates is, as we say, play down the middle of the fairway, right? I mean, fiscal realities exist, and we can't ignore those. But we're going to build rates that reflect the cost of delivering services based upon the analysis that we do. And then if there's not adequate funding, then the rates need to be scaled back from there. But we do that in a very transparent fashion, right? So Arizona is actually a really good example of that. When we first set rates way back in 2003, 2004 as the predecessor firm, the state can only afford to pay 93% of the rates. We didn't say, well, we're just going to cut everything by 7%, and this is what the rates are going to be. We said, this is what the rates should be. This is what the state can afford to pay, and there's a gap of 7%. That became very powerful for the provider community and the other stakeholders in Arizona to lobby the legislature, right? They said, this is what the consultant said, this is what we can afford, and over the course of 5 years, they moved from 93% to 100%, and furthermore, we also did annual inflationary adjustments in Arizona based upon another statute that exists. So that 7% actually translated to over 22% because we were funding both annual inflation as well as closing the gap. So that's the way we prefer to approach it. I mean, we're going to set rates that we think reflect the cost of delivering services. Then we have to take a look at the resources that are available, right? I mean, the state can't pay what it doesn't have. And if there's a gap, we're going to be very transparent. This is where the rates ought to be. This is what the state can afford. Same thing that we're doing in Oregon, as a matter of fact, as well. I mean, we're setting what we call benchmarks, and then there's adopted rates, and the gap is the funding, the shortfall that we have. So we don't go in saying this is what we need to achieve. I mean, that we have, you know, we're obviously need to protect our credibility, so we're going to build rates that we can stand behind and justify. You want to talk a little bit about the consumer impacts in states like New Mexico, where, in my parlance, rather modest rate reductions were implemented. It's hard, obviously, to measure some of the things that you're looking for. There's not really good data collection around quality. There's things like the NCI that are out there, but those are based upon a reasonably small sample, so you don't know how a given individual is impacted. I can tell you, this is not exactly what you asked, I did take a look at the impact in the provider community themselves to see the people lose access, the people who are delivering services to them. And don't quote me on the numbers because I don't have it in this presentation, but it was something like 3 or 4 providers went out of business in the couple of years before and after. One of them, as I recall, was acquired by another provider. One of them, the state put out of business for previous quality issues, let's say. So that had nothing to do with the rate study, but they were before the rate study and not after the rate study. And then one provider did appear to make a business decision to just not deliver services anymore in New Mexico. But there was no mass exodus provider saying we can no longer afford to deliver services. It did not look like it was disruptive in that sense at all. You're right. The only other thing I jotted down for myself is that, you know, providers certainly did not advocate on behalf of the rate reduction, and that's part of the reason I have these slides in here is to be forthcoming about the results of our work. But I also say that even in most of the states where we recommended rate increases, I've yet to have anyone erect a statue in my honor and say, you did fine work. You know, that's just, we don't get that kind of feedback regardless of what we end up recommending is kind of the burden of being a consultant, I suppose. So I'm not sure if I answered everything that you asked. Is there anything else that I've omitted? That
there'll be other questions.
I hope
I'm
so.
I'm sure from this little group, plus the public too. It's just I just want to emphasize that any assessment or any look about whether certain goals were achieved needs to always have the impact on the person being served or not served, because that's the true measurement of whether something is is truly successful or fails to meet a goal. So that's just, but thanks for answering the question.
And I guess I'll just echo the point that Chris made, is that in terms of the assessment, we're not been tasked with recommending any changes to assessment procedures here in California. We're going to recommend that you adopt a new assessment instrument. That's not what it is we're doing. There was another, yes, sir.
Dana Hooper. I guess I was just going to say Marty's questions are all valid. Maybe we could just hold off asking questions until you actually present, because the very next slide, you define what you are going to do. And I think it would be, I would like to, you know, to get into the meat of what you're going to do.
So I think this is where I left off, and I think I actually finished this. So Hawaii was another state where we recommended some rather sizable rate increases. Spent some time actually lobbying legislators over there on behalf of the state, and we were successful, first getting it in the governor's budget and then getting in the legislative budget. So implementation of those rates began in July of this past summer, July of 17. So, again, I went through those other states pretty quickly because I'm not suggesting that any of those outcomes are going to be particular to California, right? Each rate study, as I said, is based on the unique circumstances in a state at a given point in time. But what I do want to point out and kind of conclude with as it relates to those other things is that oftentimes rate studies are coupled with other policy sorts of intents of the state, right? It could be adding or deleting services from a program. It could be adopting a new assessment instrument. And again, this is not necessarily what we're looking at here, but a rate study just reflects the state's policies, and if those policies are changes, it's a little harder to isolate the impacts of the rates in particular because we might be funding things that are different than what we were funding yesterday. And the other thing that I wanted to just highlight there is the reason I took the time to go through those slides is some folks have suggested that all we do as an organization is go around the country cutting provider rates. And that's just demonstrably false. I mean, I stand behind the rate studies that we did in states like New Mexico, and I stand behind those results. But to suggest that that's indicative of all of our work across the country is misleading. So if you actually were to count them up, we've recommended rate increases more regularly than rate reductions. And if you look at the magnitude of the increases are much greater than the magnitude of the reductions as well. And I guess the other point I just wanted to, I'll leave it aside because for our time constraints, it's not particularly relevant here. So now I wanted to turn briefly to our typical approach to rate setting. So as we kind of demonstrated, we've done this in quite a few states. So we have a process that we ordinarily follow, and I wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about that. So fundamentally, as a consultant, our role is to provide assistance to DDS, right? This is their rate study. It's not my rate study. I'm here to help guide the process based upon our experience and our expertise in this area. But ultimately, DDS is the one that's going to be making final decisions, any policy changes that need to accompany the rates. I do want to emphasize that in addition to looking at the rates themselves, just doing the rate study, some of the things that we are tasked with considering as we're going through this project, based upon the legislation and the contract, is disparities, and is there a way that the rates can help alleviate some of those disparities? It's looking at things like outcomes. Is there a way that we can incentivize outcomes and quality services through the rate study? One of the other things that we're charged with doing is looking at the code structure itself, so the service codes and subcodes. Again, is there opportunities to simplify that, I believe, is the language that was included in the contract. And then obviously, at the end of the day, we're going to have to come up with a fiscal impact of whatever it is we recommend. So we're going to do the rates, and then we're going to say this is how much it would potentially cost, and then decisions have to be made about what the priorities are and how to move forward with that information. But we're going to do that in a very above-board, transparent fashion. In terms of the specific tasks that we're going to be doing, we're going to be reviewing service requirements and DDS's goals, and that's going to be part of this conversation as well. We're going to be communicating with and involving stakeholders throughout the process. We'll be doing data collection analysis, developing the rate models, considering the impacts related to provider network sufficiency, compliance with FLSA and HCBS requirements, other things I mentioned already, and then ultimately providing implementation support if we're able to move forward with actually making changes to some of these rates. The manner in which we set rates, the kind of generic title that we've used, is an independent rate model approach. And we use that term to indicate that we're not looking for information from a single source. We look at information from a variety of different sources. And that's kind of what I summarized there at the bottom part of this slide. Certainly, things like policies, rules, and standards impact the cost of delivering services. We're going to have a number of opportunities for provider and stakeholder feedback and input throughout this process. published sources like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the kind of setting market wage assumption, a variety of other special studies, that's going to incorporate things like geographic differences across the state. So we'll do an analysis of travel distances and travel times in different parts of the state and how that impacts provider costs. Do we see differences in access to services in different parts of the state? And if so, what should we do about that? So we're going to do a lot of that sort of analysis and research as well. But ultimately, the top bullet kind of summarizes what it is our bottom line goal is. We want to build rates that reflect the cost to deliver services consistent with the state's requirements, right? The state defines what the services are, and the regional state and regional centers define those requirements. But once those are defined, we should pay rates that reflect those requirements. Yes, ma'am.
Keisha Butler, State Council on Developmental Disabilities. My question is that with the rate study, are you going to be looking at the rate study in the present tense or in the future? Meaning that are you going to be projecting out in the future what the rates are going to be in the future, or are you looking at it in the present tense?
That's a really excellent question. So by definition, some of the data that we're going to be looking at is retrospective, right? We can only gather information associated with costs as they exist today or as they existed previously when we're gathering information from providers. But certainly that's why we have the process that we have, is once we have that information, then we want to have a detailed conversation about, does this reflect what we're looking to have in the future? So an example that I gave you is the way we've handled rates in Arizona historically. We set rates based upon the cost of delivering services today, but then we do an annual review of the adequacy and appropriateness of those rates. And although they've gotten away from this in recent years, historically the state has said, well, based upon various measures, those rates ought to have been inflated by 2% or 3%, and they're adjusted on an ongoing basis. Again, most states don't do that because it is costly to update your rates every single year, but that's certainly a conversation that we can have. And the other thing that I'm going to get to in a couple of slides is the level of detail that we put into our presentation. So we make specific assumptions around things like wages and benefits and mileage costs. So mileage is a really easy example. When we build the rate model, we build the mileage cost in using the IRS reimbursement rate, typically. Sometimes we use a higher rate, but typically we use the IRS rate. And that's published by the IRS every December, right? So that gets changed year to year to year. Because of the way we build the rate models, a state can go in without consultant assistance, frankly, and change that number from the current 53.5 cents to 55 cents or 52 cents or whatever it changes to the following year. And a number of the assumptions work in that fashion. We document where our data source came from, and as that data source is updated, the state can come in and make adjustments to the rate models, or you can do that independently and say this is what you should have done to the state.
That's excellent. Thank you.
So as I was just saying, when we build these rate models, we outline our specific assumptions. So we don't just say that we think a rate ought to be $15. We say it's based upon this level of payment to the direct support professional. This is what their benefit package looks like. This is their productivity, which I'll come back to in a moment. And that way we're having a really informed conversation, because we want to be very specific and upfront about how it is we arrived at that $15 an hour. If I just said $15 an hour, I can guarantee you someone's going to say it should be $18. And I would say, nah, and you'd say, uh-huh, and we're not going to get anywhere, right? But by outlining our specific assumptions, we can have a really informed conversation about, what you've assumed for wages is not sufficient. We're not going to be able to hire people at that wage. Ultimately, someone has to make a decision about what to do about that, but at least we can get into conversations about exactly how we arrived at that bottom line number. One point that I wanted to emphasize here, and some conversation I had during the lunch hour as well, we have to make assumptions in order to build rates, right? I mean, we have to arrive at the bottom line somehow. But the assumptions that we build in the rate models are not prescriptive upon providers. So we're going to assume that a staff person is making, to make up a number, $15 an hour. But that's not us saying that you have to pay them $15 an hour, right? You have to operate within the bottom line rates as a business, and you have to deliver services consistent with the state's requirements and folks' individual service plans. But outside of that, we're not here to dictate on a micromanaging basis, this is exactly the benefits you have to offer your staff, this is exactly what you have to pay them.
This is Dana Hooper. I guess I'd like some clarification there. We at least in California, have a system where local, county, state, and federal governments can all determine provider costs, whether it's minimum wage or whether it's mandated hours or any number of different regulations. how will you reflect those mandates? Because I think that goes way beyond choosing what to pay a wage.
Yeah, so a good point. I think minimum wage is an example of that, right? I mean, we're going to be very above board in terms of what we build into the rate models. And one of the conversations we're going to have is to what extent should rates vary from region to region and on what basis should they vary. So we've done regional rates in a number of different states, and ordinarily there's two things that drive differences in cost as it relates to HCBS. The first is wage variability. And so we did rates, as I mentioned earlier, in Virginia. And if you know much about Virginia, you have the D.C. Beltway, which is a much higher cost portion of the state than the rest of the state. So even before we got there, we didn't come up with this idea. Before we got there, they had rates that they called NOVA, or Northern Virginia, and rates for ROS, or rest of the state. So when we built rate models, we maintained that difference, and the difference in terms of cost was driven entirely by wage differentials, paying higher wages for folks in the northern part of the state versus everywhere else. The other frequent driver of cost differentials are travel distances. So we've done, Hawaii is a good example, that's top of my mind. We have fees on the different fee schedule for the Big Island because, as the name implies, it's bigger than the other islands, and there's a lot more driving that takes place on that island to get from the office to the people that you're providing services to, or to get people from their homes to the day program or anything along those lines. And we've done similar things in states like Arizona and New Mexico. Well, there's another category that's less common, but it goes to an issue that was raised before. You might also have differences in physical plant costs. So we have built in, I think, Oregon, as a matter of fact, or maybe Virginia, where for day programs we're paying for the capital cost, we have a higher cost based upon kind of an analysis of the market in that state, where you have it's more expensive to acquire or lease the industrial or other types of space that those services are typically delivered at. So we'll be having those conversations. And again, when we get to the end of the rate study and have draft rate models in front of you, we'll show you how it is we've addressed that. It may or may not be to your satisfaction, but at least we'll be able to have a conversation about it at that point in time.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Will Sanford, in California, it's probably not miles, but time.
Yeah.
L.A., you can travel 2 miles and take you 3 hours. Up here, I can go 150 miles in that same 2 hours. So that's one. And the other one would be related to wages. It's not necessarily inside industry, but if you're in the Bay Area and you're competing with, Twitter, Google, name them, the hourly wage is not going to have any relationship to necessarily service. The demand for staff is going to be the challenge. So it's going to be one where you have to really look at other industries and the economics of an area versus purely what our industry would necessarily pull down.
Sure, and thank you for both of those comments. I abbreviated myself because we actually, when we're talking about travel, we look at both of those components because I've worked in enough states where whenever I make that statement, my urban friends always say, yeah, but they're traveling 75 miles on a rural highway, right, where I'm stuck in stop-and-go traffic. So we did that analysis in Hawaii, and surprisingly, the stop-and-go traffic that we saw in Honolulu did not justify a difference there compared to the rest of the state, that they weren't traveling markedly slower there than other parts of that particular state. But when we do this, I mean, we have a way to access the Google Maps or other things that actually measures not just driving distance but also driving time, and that's part of our geographic analysis. And I'm also not disagreeing with you on the wages issue. The thing that surprised me in Northern Virginia is I expected that the average wage there was higher just because of the composition of the workforce, because you have a lot of people who are connected to the federal government, but it actually trickled all the way down, where regardless of the occupation we were looking at, because of the cost of living differences, every occupation had a differential in that part of the state versus the rest of the state. So yes, I don't disagree with either of the points that you make.
Well, I think in Honolulu they have Hawaii time, so if it takes them an hour, they don't really care.
I have no comments. I have clients there. The bottom part of this slide reflects something that I think is going to be second nature to many of the folks in the room. But when we're talking about building rates for a service, we might not have a single rate, right? In fact, more often than not, we have multiple rates based upon differences in service for a given service. And we put a handful of reasons there. So the first we touched on a little bit, individuals' level of need can drive differences in the rate for services, and that's actually the way you provide your group homes, your community care facilities currently, right? You have the 2 through 4I or 4J. That's, again, reflective of individual's level of need or the staffing that's put within the homes. Same thing is true of the day programs, right? Anytime you're talking about shared staffing and you're providing services to people with more significant needs, that's going to be more costly because they need more intensive staffing, smaller groups, or more hours of support. Group size kind of flows from the previous one. That's typically a function, or oftentimes at least a function, of individual's level of need. The service setting, so particularly when we're talking about early intervention, where there's the emphasis on the natural environment, delivering services in the natural environment is more costly oftentimes than in a clinical environment, because if you're a therapist at the clinic, you can see 6 or 7 people in an 8-hour shift. But if you're in the community, because you're driving from one to the next, you're only able to see 3 or 4 or 5 people at the most. Staff qualifications and training, the obvious example that we always use there is if we're building rates for nursing, we're not going to assume that an LPN makes the same wage as an RN, because that's just not what the market suggests. And then geography, as we've talked about at length here, the two or potentially three factors that drive those differences. So when we build HCBS rates, there's 5 factors that you're going to see in all the rates that we build. 3 of them relate to the direct care workers. So that's the wage that they receive, their fringe benefits, and their productivity. And I'll come back to each of those in just a moment. And then 2 of them relate to agency overhead costs, which we divide between program support and administration. And then there's other factors that are going to be service-specific. So if we're talking about a community-based service, we're going to have to account for the cost of travel unless it's unbundled. But if the cost of travel is bundled in, that will have to be reflected in that rate. If we're talking about a facility-based or potentially residential service, we're going to have to talk about the cost of the physical plant. If we're talking about a service like a day program that relies on people showing up, we're going to have to make assumptions about attendance. The point that you made earlier about occupancy is particularly relevant to residential programs, particularly short-term residential programs, right? So just reacting to what you said earlier, you know, when we build a rate for a traditional group home, we're going to assume that occupancy is going to be pretty high. And we'll have to talk about when people are occasionally absent to spend weekends with their natural family or get hospitalized. But by and large, you have a stable population. You're not having a lot of churn in the typical group homes. When we're talking about a crisis home, though, particularly depending upon the length of the stay, we're going to expect a lot more churn and a lot more empty bed nights. So I did rates actually for the behavioral health system in Maine as well as the DD system, and we recommended pretty sizable rate increases for their community crisis homes, or what they call crisis stabilization facilities. And part of it was driven by the fact that we can't assume that they're going to have those beds full 365 nights a year, particularly because the expectation that people are going to be out of there within like 14 days. So if you're discharging people that quickly, you don't necessarily have a waiting list of people who are having a crisis that need a bed immediately. So yeah, those are the sorts of things that we certainly take into account when we're building these types of rates. So I have an example here, which you probably can't read the numbers, but I'm heartened to know that you got a handout that actually has it there. So this is a nursing rate that we built in Hawaii. So the first top part of the box are those three categories that I said are related to the direct care workforce. So the wage that they are paid. If you want to be a registered nurse and earn a lot of money, you should move to Hawaii. They make about $90,000 a year on average. The employee benefit rate, we have at 16.6%. What you don't see in the packet, but if you went out to our website or if you've looked at some of the rate packets that we've done elsewhere, is we don't just tell you we have a benefit rate of 16.6%. You know exactly what's built into that. We outline, obviously, FICA, the Social Security and Medicare taxes, state and federal unemployment insurance, health insurance costs, other benefits, and paid time off. And again, that 16.6% is derived from those specific numbers. So if you were to flip to the back of this packet, which you don't have, obviously, but you would know exactly where that 16.6% came from. And productivity there is the middle part of that top box. And this concept is important, and it's going to be relevant really to all the service that we're looking at. We recognize that people cannot be billable for 100% of their time. And that same thing is as true as a consultant, right? When I'm sitting on an airplane, I'm not billing any of my clients for that time, but I'm still being paid. Same thing is true for your employees, for those of you who are vendors out there, right? If you're driving from one member to the next, and sometimes you can't bill for that time, but assuming you can't bill for that time, they're still on the clock, right? I mean, you're still required by federal and state law to pay them for that time. So we need to account for those non-billable activities that are part of delivering services, but we need to spread it across the billable hours. So without going through the details, if we assume a 40-hour work week for this particular service, we're assuming that nurses can only bill for 26 hours per week. So you need to pay them for 40, but you need to spread that cost over the 26 hours that you can actually bill for. And so that's going to be one of the issues that is going to be one of the thornier conversations that we have with vendors when we get a little bit further into the project. This is one of the areas where we have a lot of disagreements, I think, ordinarily. Yes, ma'am.
Disabilities. Does that mean that the nurse actually gets rate per 15 minutes? Does that mean that the nurse only gets $24.78 per 15 minutes billable? Is that what that stat means?
If you're looking at the very bottom line, for the most part, nurses work for agencies in Hawaii. So the agency is being paid $199 an hour or a little less than $25 per 15 minutes for that nurse's direct care billable hours.
Mm-hmm. And so basically rounding up, the nurses only getting paid $25 every 15 minutes?
Well, the agency, her employer, is being paid that. We're assuming that she's making $44.37 per hour.
Oh, okay. So the nurses getting paid $44.37 per hour.
That's what we're assuming.
That we're assuming.
Yes.
And so the rate per 15 minutes is what the agency is making.
Correct.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, of course. So that, in a nutshell, is those three: wages, benefits, productivity, that are related to the direct care worker. Then we have two factors that are specific to agency overhead costs. We divide them into two categories: administration, which is the old Supreme Court definition. You know it when you see it, right? So it's things like your executive leadership, your accounting functions, human resources, information technology. These are costs that exist regardless of the service that you're delivering, right? You have to have those functions regardless of what it is you're doing. Program support is more program specific, but it's not part of direct care. So it's things like your frontline supervision, curriculum development, training, quality assurance. Those are going to be dictated by the services specifically that you're offering and providing. If you look at work we were doing 10 or 15 years ago, we combined them to a single category for administration, but we stopped doing that for a couple of reasons. First, I think it's a little bit misleading. And then secondly, it offered a pretty big target for policymakers, right? Because we would say administration is 20 or 25%. They said, well, why should we pay 20 or 25%? And we'd have to explain, well, it's not just administration like you're thinking about. It's also this frontline supervision that really is critical to delivering quality services. So as we've thought about this over the years, we've actually divided that into two categories. That being said, there's a lot of gray area, right? I mean, sometimes a provider can say that this is administrative expense, and the provider can say the same thing as a program support expense. So we still look at them in combination, but from a rate model perspective, we think it's important to delineate that these are two discrete responsibilities and activities that providers have. Yes, sir.
So on that split, are you doing some sort of detailed breakdown like you have in the other one, just sort of how did you get to $15 program funding per day?
Less so is the honest answer. And certainly as we're going through this project, we can think about whether or not there's a greater level of detail we can provide. But we're more challenged there because administrative costs, for example, are going to be really – in a lot of ways, provider-specific, right? I mean, you're going to have different cost structures if you're a smaller provider than if you're a larger provider. So one of the things that we typically see, as an example, is a multi-state provider might have relatively low administrative staff costs because so many of their administrative functions are being delivered by the corporate office, right? So they're carving off 7 or 8% of their bill, and it's getting sent to corporate, who's handling a lot of these, say, accounting functions, for example. So if we built a rate model that says this is how much we're paying for executive leadership, it's going to look very different for the national organization. Pardon me, the national organization versus the organization that's headquartered here in the state. And CMS has asked me similar questions, and my response to them, frankly, was, you know, we're not trying to account for the number of staples that a provider is using over the course of a year. We can't get to that level of detail. We show you where the numbers came from. So when we do the provider survey, for example, we break it out into individual cost categories. So you can see this is how much providers say they're spending on information technology, office equipment, office supplies, insurance, dues, memberships, et cetera, et cetera. So we gather information at a really detailed level. But when it comes to building the rate models, we typically amalgamate it, and we don't have an assumption about the number of staples that you're using over the course of the year.
Yeah, mine was more in the program support. So that's more
sure.
A different way. So you're looking really, that's really much more personnel, support, training, those kind of factors, and the administrative piece that's out there, which would be counting the staples.
Sure. So thank you for that clarification. And So in Hawaii, we did not do that. If you look at rates that we just released in Oregon within the past couple months, we actually, rather than just showing the $15, we said what we're paying for, which was, in this case, was that frontline supervision. So we said this is the supervisor's cost, this is their span of control, and that's how we handled it in that particular state. So certainly we've done that in the past. It's going to be a matter of what cost we want to pay for and what consistency we think we have across providers when we're doing that. And then after you get through those five components, three related to direct support, two related to agency overhead costs, the other variables are going to be determined on the service that we're looking at. So this is community-based nursing, so we have a cost in there for mileage and a cost in there for supplies. So that's things like the masks, and it could be the car covers if they're doing any sort of transportation, that kind of thing. If you were looking at a day program rate model, which is longer and it would fit even more poorly on this PowerPoint slide, you'd have a lot more things in there about things like absences, whether or not you're paying for meals or not over the course of a day, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm a consultant, so I always have to talk about why the way we do things is the right way to do things, and that's what we attempt to do on this particular slide. We see three primary benefits to approaching rates in the manner in which we approach them. I think fundamentally, I like to believe it's a very transparent process. So you saw in that previous model, this is what we're paying for a nurse, and if you look at Appendix A of that packet, you show exactly where that $44.37 came from. Appendix B indicates where that 16.6% came from for the benefit rate, et cetera, et cetera. And that allows us to have the conversation that's meaningful about, well, we don't think $45 an hour is adequate. You know, it costs us $55 an hour to recruit a nurse. Again, we might not agree at the end of the day, and we might say, well, we're going to stick with $44, but at least we're going to know exactly where that bottom line rate, the $25 per quarter hour, came from. So our goal is not necessarily to reach agreement, and I can almost guarantee you we're not going to reach agreement on every single assumption that we make, but you're going to know what it is and where it came from. We also think that this approach allows the state to incorporate policy objectives into the rates. Again, by detailing it in the level that we are, if they want to make a specific targeted adjustment, they can do that. So a couple of examples could be training. So we say how much training was as a productivity adjustment over the course of the year. We expect people to get 50 hours of training. The state says, well, no, we want them to start taking MANT training or something along those lines. We're going to add another 25 hours per year. You don't need to go through a whole full-blown rate study and pay a consultant to do that. You can just take out the 50 hours, put in 75 hours, and the rate gets recalculated. And certainly on the front end, before you even get to making adjustments, if we want to incentivize things like community-based services versus center-based services, we can make sure the rates reflect those sorts of policy designs. And then to the question that was raised earlier, these models also lend themselves to being maintained over time, which is actually, I think, one of the requirements of taking a look at this fee schedule is how can we put something that is sustainable into place. So again, we think that states ought to take a look at their rates on a periodic basis, but you shouldn't have to do a rate study every single year because it's so time-consuming on your side as providers and on our side and the state side, and then certainly for the state side in terms of cost. So because we dictate where our data sources came from, like mileage, like wages, like benefits, I mean, we put in, I forget what's in health insurance in Hawaii, but say we did $450 a month. If you did a study and it turns out that health insurance is $500 a month, you can make an adjustment, recalculate the rates without having to go through a full-blown rate study. So now we're going to turn a little bit to what we're talking about doing here in California. So the first thing that we wanted to cover was some guiding principles that we've established in conversations with DDS. Now, again, these are high level, certainly, and don't dictate the day-to-day work, but we wanted to emphasize what we're looking to accomplish here. So first, we're going to utilize this independent rate-setting approach, right, where we're going to dictate where our assumptions came from and what it is we've built into the rate model so that you know where that bottom-line cost came from. And we're going to do that based upon information from a variety of different sources. As John alluded to, we're going to be doing a provider survey, and that's certainly going to be very informative, but it's not going to be dispositive, right? We're going to look at information from a variety of other sources as well. And then we want to ensure that rates reflect, to the extent practical, various goals have been established. So that's things like an efficient payment structure. So we're looking at things like units of service and billing codes, provider network sufficiency, including for underserved areas and groups, supporting quality services and desired outcomes, obviously making sure that we have rates that support your compliance as vendors with HCBS and FLSA requirements, and then rates that can be maintained and sustained. We want to ensure that our process is transparent and inclusive, so there's going to be meaningful opportunities for engagement. I'm obviously speaking very quickly for a very limited amount of time today, but I think we're going to have much more in-depth working meetings in the months ahead, with if not this group. work group that you've established. Outside the DS task force, as some of you have seen, if folks want me to present to their organizations or their groups, I've been happy to do so, and we'll continue to do that. There's other groups that are kind of on deck that we have scheduled over the next month or two, and we'll continue to meet with those folks who request this type of presentation. And then to the point that was raised earlier, we're going to build rates that are independent of budgetary considerations. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we're going to implement rates that are independent of budgetary considerations, because that's impossible. But when we're building rates, we're going to build rates that we think are appropriate to deliver services consistent with the requirements that have been established. When we get to that point, and if money is not sufficient, decisions will have to be made or a legislative package will have to be developed, but we're going to build rates that we think are reflective of actual service delivery. So turning to what our specific tasks are, the first item is something we spent quite a bit of time on, I should say. So background research and analysis. Because as they say, when you've seen one IDD system, you've seen one IDD system, right? When we set rates for hospitals, say an appendectomy in Maine looks pretty similar to an appendectomy in Hawaii. But when we're looking at HCBS, there is a wide degree of variation from state to state to state. And a day program is a really good example of that. So some states will allow groups of up to 1 to 10, right? You have 10 consumers per one staff person. That's what Georgia allows. Hawaii historically, or Maine historically, has allowed 1 to 3. Well, it's a lot more expensive to deliver 1 to 3 services than it is to deliver 1 to 10 services, although they're both rehabilitation services. Is transportation part of the day program provider's responsibility or not? If it's part of their responsibility, that's a significant additional cost to delivering a day program if you can't bill for it, if it's bundled into the rate. Are providers responsible for delivering meals to the people that are at their program? In most states, they're not responsible. People pack their own. But if those states like Mississippi who do require them to provide lunch, they need to be factored into the rate model. So we're not going to know what those differences are until we spend some time taking a look at service definitions, having conversations with the DDS, and ultimately having conversations with the regional centers and with vendors to understand what rehabilitation means here in California, because it's not going to be the same thing it means here in any other state that we've worked in. So we've done a lot of time reading through the Lanterman Act, reading through the regulations, and having a lot of in-depth conversations with the state folks as well. And then we're also doing at the same time analysis of purchase of service and claims data as well, so we can understand what the variability is in terms of unit definitions from regional center to regional center, understand what regional centers are using a service that's not being used at all in other regional services, in other regional center catchment areas. So that's taken quite a bit of time, frankly. You have obviously a large and sprawling system, and it's taken a little bit of time to get our arms around everything, but I think we're pretty close to getting there. That's allowed us to move on to some of the next phases of the project. So we've had these kickoff meetings. Although you only have to listen to me for an hour, hour and a half here today, I subjected my friends at DDS to 3 straight days of listening to me talk at this rate of speed. So that was a grueling week for them, I'm sure. No, but I gave them 100-page outlines of my questions. So certainly this is a high-level conversation, as I said, but we're going to be moving forward with some more detailed conversations with regional center representatives likely, as well as the rates work group or the DS task force, depending on how the group decides to proceed with that. One of the next things that we're looking to do in the next couple of months is get a provider survey out there. And so I know you've been surveyed recently, so I hope there's not going to be survey fatigue, but this is a critical element of our work, is understanding what your current cost structures look like. So it's going to be a pretty detailed instrument. I can tell you that before it gets released, we are going to bring it back to, if not this group, at least the rates work group, and get feedback on it. We're going to ask people maybe to do a little bit of testing on it to make sure it's working as it's intended. We hope to have that first meeting of the presentation of the draft sometime in January or so, but there's still a fair amount of work that needs to be done. And then if all goes according to plan, the survey would be out in February or so, out to the larger provider community. Concurrently with the provider survey, we'll be doing the other research and analysis. So as I've mentioned a couple of times already, we'll be looking at sources of information outside of provider cost data. So we'll be doing that sort of research at the same time.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
On the provider survey, and I don't know if this goes out of the scope of what the I'm trying to remember what the contract, the RF, but in terms of the provider survey, which I think is great, and making sure that the outreach is done as extensive as possible, but will there be a survey, or actually I would think that there should be a survey of some sort, and I'm not sure if it's part of your contract, that surveys people who receive services and the families as well, because one of the things is that whatever rates model is going to be put forward has to be not just sustainable in resources, but it has to work in relationship to what is needed out in the community. Providers do know to some extent what's needed, but there's a great number of people in the community who feel that there's an unmet need or things are not provided in the way they would like it to be. So you're just getting one half of the sky if we're just doing the, well, maybe more than one half of the sky, but the other part of that is surveying the people who either need services, receive services, or the families who are associated with those. And I don't know, I'm looking at Nancy, she's saying, that's maybe a Nancy question, or maybe it's a Chris question.
No, I have an answer to the question. So there is going to be an involvement for feedback from everyone that's impacted by the system, right? We're not putting together a formal survey like we are for the providers, because the providers is going to be very structured. How much do you pay your staff? What benefits do you offer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And that sort of insights the consumers and families aren't going to have. So I'll come back to that in about 30 seconds in terms of what that process is going to look like. So after we've gathered data from the providers, from other sources that we're going to look to, we're going to build draft rate models. And it's going to look very much like we just saw for the Hawaii nursing rate, right? So we're going to say for every service that's included in our scope of work, and then if a given service has different rate variants, we're going to have a different rate model for each of those variants, right? So if you have different rates for different parts of the state, there's going to be one rate model for this part of the state versus this part. So it's going to be undoubtedly a large packet when we get to that stage. Yes, sir.
Will Sanford. So on that, again, we're in transition to a final rule in which a number of services that are currently existing are no longer going to potentially be fundable, at least by federal dollars, could be funded by state dollars, which is going to cause a whole shift in what they're reporting. They're telling you what we did yesterday, but tomorrow we have to do something totally different. How are you going to sort of look for the gaps in service, so to speak, in order to convert folks across?
Yeah, good question. And I think we, perhaps in our artful way, I tried to address that earlier, because you're right that by definition, when we're collecting information, it's going to be retrospective, right? I mean, that's, we're getting information as the system exists today, or more specifically, a year ago. But we're going to have to look to the future in terms of what we need to deliver. So that's really going to be handled through conversations more than anything else, right? We're going to be talking to DDS, we're going to be talking to the task force, the rates worker, we're going to be talking with other organizations about what they see as the impact of the HCBS rule and other requirements that are potentially coming down the pike. I mean, certainly this is not unique to California, right? All states are going to be going to have to comply with the HCBS rule. So we certainly have some insights into that, and it can be things like in residential rate models, you might need to start putting more staffing into residential services that people can have opportunities to have individualized attention, right? It's no longer going to be good enough where if it's movie night, everyone has to go to the movies. If someone doesn't want to go to the movies, you don't take them to the movies, right? And if you don't take them to the movies, you need to have a staff person that stays behind in order to deliver care to them. So I mean, those are the sorts of conversations that we'll have to make sure that the rates that we build are going to be reflective of the way services are going to look tomorrow. But from a data collection perspective, we really have no ability to foresee the future, so we're going to gather information about current costs, and we're going to have conversations about how to adjust those costs to reflect what the new requirements are going to look like.
Actually, Steve, if I could, Marty from CECAN, actually there would be a way to measure that and not in a future way, because with the HCBS transition funding that's underway, then there you have providers who are transitioning or making the attempt to transition parts or the entire program into a model that is compliant from a model that is not compliant. And one of the questions I had for John actually a couple of months ago, or maybe it was Jim Knight, is how does DDS pay those providers in the coming year or two when their program model has now changed, has changed as a result of the transition funding? And so it no longer resembles the program plan that was actually authorized by the regional center or by the state of California. So you will have actually models potentially that will exist in real time, you know, for your study. And so actually we would be curious how you would examine those. Like, well, Will, you have at least a couple of programs that are under that. So thank you.
So when we get to the draft rate models, we're going to put those out. We're actually going to do a kind of a pre-presentation with this group to let you know what it is we're planning to do. But that will kick off effectively a public comment process. And that public comment process, we want to be as public-facing as possible. Certainly, we're going to be relying on various groups to help filter comments, because we can't, you know, we don't have the ability to process comments from 300,000 people or tens of thousands of providers. But certainly, when we get to that point, we're going to be wanting to reach out to groups, make a presentation to them, get their feedback on what it is we're thinking of doing. And I can tell you that process is very value-added. I went back and looked at one particular study because it had been remarked upon in other forums. And when we did that public comment process in New Mexico, we actually made 20 different changes to what we had originally proposed. So across, you know, a number of different services, but there was a total of 20 different services. People can have differences of opinion, and ultimately the state will change its mind. There could have been something that we overlooked, but it really is a value-added process. Just because we put something out as a draft rate, we really are looking for feedback and take that feedback seriously, and we'll make adjustments accordingly. And that's, again, that's one of those opportunities for folks to weigh in about whether or not what we're proposing is going to work for them and their loved ones. Yes, ma'am.
Keisha Weller, State Council on Development Disabilities. In terms of the project task, What's the timeline for each of the steps that you have listed on your PowerPoint slide? What is the timeline for the background research analysis, kickoff meeting, provider survey, and other stuff that you have on your PowerPoint slide there? What's the timeline?
Well, so you've noticed my obvious omission, and that omission was intentional. Because we're not quite on the schedule that we would like to have been on. It's taken us a little bit of time to gather some of the data that we wanted, and took some time, obviously, to process all the claims information. There's some other things. So we're a little bit behind where we liked to be. But we have to deliver the report to BDS by the end of the calendar year. So everything has to be done by December 31st, 2018. I'm not going to commit to any specific months, but I can give you some standards in terms of how long we expect some of these activities to last
once
they
start.
Okay,
sounds good.
The provider survey, we're looking at giving providers a minimum of 30 days to complete it, and that's certainly negotiable, but that's as a starting point, a minimum of 30 days to complete it once it gets released. Public comment period is similar. We'll start the public comment period. People have at least 30 days to submit their comments, and obviously it'll take us time to read all those comments. But, I mean, when we're talking about public-facing things, those are kind of the two big tasks, and we want to give folks at least 30 days to provide, you know, informed input on those.
Okay, and I have one more question. I know that there's been lots of action on the federal level. What is the state of California going to do with the rate study project if the federal matching system falls through? Like if the federal legislators say we're not going to fund Medicaid anymore for the state government anymore, and to fund the regional center system, the state of California has to do it. And the federal government says we're going to put a per capita cap on Medicaid. What's going to happen to the rate program?
I don't know.
this is Chris, and you know, I think I said this on the forums that, you know, until hopefully those dire things don't happen, but if they do, that would be, you know, we start those conversations about what we're going to do. Right now, we're going to proceed with our rate process. Like Stephen said, you know, they do their process and they give us an impartial outcome, and then the state has to decide what they're going to do with it, how much of it they can fund, that sort of thing. So if we had negative things come out from the federal government, that's going to be part of the process of prioritizing and having a conversation with everybody here, the communities, and the communities outside of DD, and also, you know, larger health system. Those are going to be really hard conversations we have to go there. But it's not going to really affect what we're doing here right now, because we don't know if those things are going to happen. So right now we're just holding the course and going to keep going on and hoping that those sort of things don't happen. So,
yeah, let's hope.
Terry DeBell. So I'm presuming that the studies from the other states were smaller in scope than what needs to be done here in California, because we're a big state and we have an entitlement system, so we have more people actually in the system. Is that a correct assumption to make?
Well,
and then my follow-up thing is, but you also do Medi-Cal rate studies, so would this be similar to in scope to?
So we've not done other Medi-Cal rate studies. To be clear, we haven't done rate setting for other Medi-Cal programs previously. In terms of scope, I mean, the scope isn't really a function of how many people are being served. It's a function of the services that we're looking at. So, again, we're looking at residential services. We're looking at day services. Every state's IDD program provides residential services, day services. So the complicating factor isn't necessarily the size of California or the number of people that you serve or even that you're an entitlement system. You know, there's other states that we've worked in that are entitlement systems as well.
Okay.
What's making this a more expansive project is the regional center system, right? Because really, for some services, it looks like we have 21 different ways of delivering services. So, and particularly for some of the service codes where there's not a lot of service definitions around them. Again, what we rely upon is service requirements, right? So, you know, what are providers required to do? And for some services where it's only a couple of sentences long, there's not really a lot of insight for us to gain. That's why I mentioned earlier in the conversation that we're going to need to be having conversations with regional centers to understand, in your regional center, what does service code 055 mean versus 055 in another regional center, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that really is what makes this a bigger project than most, is understanding the differences by regional center area. But outside of that, I mean, in terms of setting rates, we're not setting rates any differently here than we would anywhere else, because, I mean, every day program is different, but it's still a day program. We know what it is we're looking for.
Okay. Thank you. It's a very comprehensive outline and discussion. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
So we'll go through the public comment process. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier, that is a value-added process and will likely. I've not gone through a public comment process that has not resulted in changes. And the way we handle that is very much like the Federal Register does. So we'll say commenters said X, Y, and Z, and this is our response. If we made a change, we'll explain what that change was. If we don't make a change, we'll explain why we didn't make a change. Again, we try to do this in as transparent a fashion as possible. So you might not agree with what our justification is, but we're going to put it in writing so you can at least read it and know where it is we're coming from. And then, obviously, the final report is due back to the legislature by statute in March of 2019. So one thing I wanted to touch on here, one of the things that has been very clear from Nancy and John and their leadership on this project is the importance of making sure that we're involving stakeholders throughout this, and I can't agree more with him on that fact, on that matter. So I wanted to spend a minute or two just talking about what our expectations are going to be of all of you, and then how it is we're going to involve groups elsewhere as well. And I'm using the task force interchangeably with the rates work group. I don't know exactly how that's going to shake out. Are we going to be having these in-depth conversations with the work group, or are we going to be doing it with the entire task force? But kind of the three or four key functions that we're asking you to serve as or provide to us is representing a larger community of stakeholders, right? It's not feasible for us to meet with everybody, and if groups want me to come and present to them, I'm happy to do that. Some folks have already talked to me about that today, I know. In fact, I think I have an outstanding request from your group as well, so we're going to be working to schedule that. But we can't just talk to everybody. So when we're having these conversations, again, we want these to be open conversations, and we want you to engage your colleagues as well. So this is not a closed system, right? We're not only looking for your feedback. We want you to go back and talk to your staff. We want you to talk to your colleagues. And when we have subsequent meetings, we want you to report back on kind of representing everybody rather than just your specific interests. Certainly, as the process is going on and you're hearing from your colleagues, feel free to answer questions about who it is we are, why they're getting emails from some guy named Stephen Plowski out in Arizona, and encourage them to participate and have a seat in this process. I think importantly, we want you to provide an on-the-ground perspective, right? Certainly, you know, we're consultants from out of state, and even DDS, although some folks certainly have experience as providers, there's no substitute for the folks who are doing this on a day-to-day basis. So that's really an important value to us to hear from exactly what's working, what's not working. And, you know, the rates may or may not be a function of that, but we want to hear that type of feedback. And it gives us an opportunity also to drill down on specific issues. If there's something that we're really interested in or we don't understand, we can have a conversation to gain that understanding. And then we're going to be asking you to take a look at materials throughout this process. So I mentioned earlier that before the provider survey goes out, we'll be presenting a draft to you here, and we'll be making revisions probably in response to feedback that we get. Before the public comment process starts, we'll present the draft rate models to you, and again, at least hear what your initial thoughts are there. And then certainly we'll ask for feedback on those draft rate models. So in terms of meetings that we think are going to occur, again, before I get the question, I don't have anything scheduled yet, but I know your time is valuable and important, so we'll work on putting this calendar together as quickly as we can. But we'll have this is effectively our kickoff meeting. The next time we want to meet is to go through a draft of the provider survey. And we're actually envisioning a lot of these as being a two-step process. Right, so we'll come to you and we'll present what it is we're thinking of doing with the provider survey, but then we'll give you some time to go back and talk to your finance and programs, have the folks who actually be completing the survey, and then we'll reconvene to get additional feedback from you, right? Because we want to make sure that you have time to fully review what it is we're proposing or suggesting. So it'll be one meeting to make a presentation about this is the provider survey, go through the instructions, and then ask you to essentially do a test run on it. We'll reconvene a couple weeks later and get your feedback. After the provider survey is done, we'll want to present the results to you. So again, we'll publish the analysis of those survey results, and if you look at projects we've done elsewhere, you can see how it is we approach that. We never publish provider-specific information. We don't say that UCP or anyone else said X, Y, and Z, but we give you aggregated information. This is the average response that was offered to us, and we calculate that in a number of different ways. But it helps us close the loop, right? We'll say this is what we heard from people who participated in the survey. And it is. I mean, we're not going to fudge the numbers, but we're going to ask you to serve as a reality check. Does this make sense to you? And if you say it doesn't make sense to you, we're not going to change the numbers because the numbers are what the numbers are going to be, but at least it gives us something to think about as we're considering that information, right? Then we get to the draft rate models. I've mentioned this already before. We'll present the draft rate models to you, and we'll reconvene, and we'll get your feedback on the draft rate models. And then certainly after the public comment process is finished, as I said, we'll give you a written report effectively of what that public comment process told us and what we did about it. But we want to close the loop with you, and we'll make a presentation so you can hear directly from us about what it is our responses are to each of the comments that we received.